Citizen Soldiers, Disc 13.
There were thousands of ordinary criminals in ETO. Hundreds of them were caught, tried by court-martial, and sentenced to the stockade, or in the case of rape or murder, to death by firing squad. 65 men were ordered shot. Eisenhower had to pass the final judgment. In 16 cases, he changed the sentence to life in the stockade. 49 men were shot. Desertion was also punishable by death by firing squad, but the U.S. Army had not carried out such a sentence since 1864. Desertion was a serious problem in ETO, partly because it was relatively easy to do in Europe. There were no desertions on the Pacific Islands. Partly because of the never-ending nature of the combat. Partly because the Army tried to get deserters back to their outfits and give them a second chance. Meaning deserters could figure there wouldn't be any punishment if they were caught. In November 1944, Lieutenant Glenn Gray, on counterintelligence duty, found a deserter in the French woods. The lad was from the Pennsylvania mountains. He was accustomed to camping out. He had been there a couple of weeks, living on venison, and intended to stay until the war ended. "All the men I knew and trained with have been killed," the deserter told Gray. "I'm lonely. The shells seem to come closer all the time, and I can't stand them." He begged Gray to leave him. Gray refused, said he would have to turn him in, but promised he would not be punished. The deserter said he knew that. He bitterly predicted they would simply put him back into the line again, which was exactly what happened when Gray brought him in. One deserter only, Private Eddie Slovic, went through the process from confession to court-martial to sentence to execution by firing squad. Slovic got to France as a replacement in August. On the 25th, he spent the night in a village, dug in with some other replacements. There was shelling. In the morning, when they moved out, he stayed behind. That afternoon, he hooked up with some Canadian infantry, with whom he spent the next 6 weeks. Then he was turned over to American MPs, who escorted him back to the company to which he had been assigned. Slovic told the CEO he was too frightened of the shelling, and swore, "If I have to go out there again, I'll run away." He later put that warning in writing at the end of a written confession of desertion. He wanted to spend the rest of the war in the stockade. Bad luck for him. By the time he came to trial, it was November 11th, and the strain of the fighting at the Siegfried Line was leading to an increase in desertions. The high command was looking to set an example. Slovic fit perfectly. He was found guilty and sentenced to execution. By the time Eisenhower gave the case its last review on January 30th, the bulge had made desertion an even greater problem. Eisenhower did not intervene. On January 31st, Slovic was executed. Slovic's case excited comment and controversy. There was a hue and cry about Army justice. Eisenhower never backed away from his decision. He thought the case about as clear-cut as one could get. But whatever the merits, it helps put the Slovic execution in some perspective to mention that during the course of the 11-month campaign in Northwest Europe, when Eisenhower had one deserter put to death, Hitler had 50,000 executed for desertion or cowardice. One of the stressful strains on platoon and company commanders was recognizing and dealing with battle fatigue. The best of them could anticipate the breaking point with an individual before it occurred and get them some rest. Severe cases went to the rear for treatment. A few returned to the front line. Many more were put on limited duty. The temptation to fake combat exhaustion was there. One evening in the Hurtgen, Lieutenant George Wilson welcomed two replacements, radio men, to his company, and directed them to a foxhole. There was some shelling. In the morning, the smaller of the two replacements dashed over to Wilson's foxhole and dove in. He was shaking violently, Wilson remembered, and tears streamed down his face. His whole frame quivered with the spasms, and he was barely able to tell me between sobs that he couldn't take it. He just had to get the hell out. I had to let him go to the rear. He sobbed like a baby during the entire outburst and beat his head on the ground. Wilson tried talking to him, to no avail. Wilson tried getting tough. I told him angrily that I had been in frontline combat for over 5 months and no one would let me go back. Since he had just arrived, he sure as hell wasn't going back. That brought on more hysteria. He sobbed that he would desert. Wilson said, "Go ahead and you'll get shot." Next, Wilson told him how ashamed his parents would be. He sobbed that he didn't care. "I'm just a dirty, no-good, yellow, Jewish SOB." Eventually, he calmed down and returned to his foxhole. But later that day, his buddy, a big man, came to Wilson and put on a similar performance, but he wasn't as convincing as the first guy. "I blew my top," Wilson wrote, and shouted at him that the two of them were trying to play me for an idiot, and I'd had it with them. Surprisingly, he readily admitted it, and even went on to describe how they had spent the night before planning the charade. It seems they both had been actors in college and had had some training. The following day, another shelling. The bigger of the two replacements went bonkers, tears streaming down his face. He begged Wilson to send him to the rear. I turned on him angrily and pointed my rifle at his chest, saying that if I heard one more word out of him, I'd shoot. He stopped bawling instantly. The shelling resumed. The man got a piece of shrapnel in his arm, the million-dollar wound. He was out of there. Wilson never saw him again, nor the first guy, who took himself to the rear and talked his way into a hospital as a battle fatigue case. In the popular World War II cartoon strip, The Sad Sack, the character was a naive, confused, lazy, bumbling private, but happy enough and almost lovable. In real life, a sad sack was a miserable person. Perpetually unhappy himself, he tried to make everyone around him equally miserable. He was filled with hate for his officers, for the army, for blacks, Jews, Italians, whoever. Whenever he could get away with it, he was a bully. He was a habitual liar. He disappeared when real work or fighting had to be done. Not only did he fail to carry his weight, he was a constant and serious drain on the Army's efficiency. At his extreme, the sad sack was a mean, vicious son of a bitch without a redeeming virtue. The worst sad sack of all was Jim Crow. The world's greatest democracy fought the world's greatest racist with a segregated army. It was worse than that. The army and the society conspired to degrade African Americans in every way possible, summed up in the name Jim Crow. One little incident from the home front illustrates the tyranny black Americans lived under during the Second World War. In April 1944, Corporal Rupert Timmingham wrote Yank magazine, "Here's a question that each Negro soldier is asking," he began. "What is the Negro soldier fighting for? On whose team are we playing?" He recounted the difficulties he and eight other black soldiers had while traveling through the South. "Where old Jim Crow rules," for a new assignment. "We could not purchase a cup of coffee," Timmingham noted. Finally, the lunchroom manager at a Texas railroad depot said the black GIs could go on around back to the kitchen for a sandwich and coffee. As they did, about 24 German prisoners of war with 2 American guards came to the station. They entered the lunchroom, sat at the tables, had their meals served, talked, smoked, in fact, had quite a swell time. I stood on the outside looking on, and I could not help but ask myself, Why are they treated better than we are? Why are we pushed around like cattle? If we are fighting for the same thing, if we are to die for our country, then why does the government allow such things to go on? Some of the boys are saying that you will not print this letter. I'm saying that you will. In ETO, many black soldiers were assigned to prisoner duty. It is the universal testimony of the German POWs interviewed for this book that they got better treatment from black than white guards, to the point that the POWs had a saying, "The best American is a black American." Old Jim Crow ruled in the army as much as in the South. Blacks had their own units, mess halls, barracks, bars. Stateside, England, France, Belgium, it didn't matter. There were no black infantry units in ETO. There were 9 Negro field artillery battalions, a few anti-aircraft battalions, and a half dozen tank and tank destroyer battalions. Some did well. Some were average. Some were poor. The 969th Field Artillery Battalion earned praise from General Maxwell Taylor for its supporting fire during the defense of Bastogne. "Our success," Taylor wrote the 969th's commander, "is attributable to the shoulder-to-shoulder cooperation of all units involved. This division is proud to have shared the battlefield with your command." He put the battalion in for a Distinguished Unit Citation, which it received on February 5th, the first Negro combat unit to be so honored. Patton had not been eager to accept black tankers because he fancied that black men did not have quick enough reflexes to drive tanks in battle. But when at the end of October, the 761st Tank Battalion, the first Negro unit committed to combat, showed up assigned to the 26th Division, 3rd Army, Patton welcomed the black tankers warmly. "Men, you're the first Negro tankers to ever fight in the American Army. I don't care what color you are, so long as you go up there and kill those kraut sons of bitches. Everyone has their eyes on you and is expecting great things from you. Most of all, your race is looking to you. Don't let them down. Don't let me down." They didn't. The battalion spent 183 days in action. Every commander it fought under sent his commendations. It won 1 Medal of Honor and many Distinguished Service Crosses. The Negro 827th Tank Destroyer Battalion, however, had a poor record. So bad that the Army almost disbanded it, and many commanders refused to have it. The causes were familiar. Untrained, with white officers who were the cast-offs of other units, poorly equipped. Shortly after the end of the war, Walter Wright, chief historian of the Army, commented that the real trouble was the inferior officers. Blacks had to have the best, Wright insisted, because American Negro troops are ill-educated on the average and often illiterate. They lack self-respect, self-confidence, and initiative. They tend to be very conscious of their low standing in the eyes of the white population, and consequently feel very little motive for aggressive fighting. "Why should they," Wright went on, "when every black soldier knew that the color of his skin will automatically disqualify him for reaping the fruits of attainment? No wonder that he sees little point in trying very hard to excel. To me, the most extraordinary thing is that such people continue trying at all." It wasn't only that the whites wouldn't reward a black soldier who did his job well. Those blacks who did strive were ridiculed by their fellows for doing so. Isaac Coleman was the second oldest of 14 children raised on a farm in Virginia. He had quit school at age 15 to work. Besides, there was no public high school for blacks in his area. He enlisted in 1941 and moved up rapidly. "Because I was ambitious and did my job the best I could. I was obedient and accepted responsibilities. Others called me Uncle Tom and worse, and I had a few run-ins with black soldiers. but I was satisfied. I made Master Sergeant when I was 20 years old. That meant $140 a month, most of which he sent home. Sergeant Coleman fought his way through Europe. He got back to Virginia in January 1946. When I got home, there was snow on the ground, and a white fellow at the bus station gave me a ride home. My father came out barefoot and picked me off the ground. Daddy cried, and we visited and saw everybody that night. Daddy had 7 boys in the war, 6 overseas at once, and we all came home. I wouldn't have minded staying in the Army, but my wife was a teacher and didn't want to quit, so I gave in. I bought a farm with the GI Bill. Most black soldiers never got a chance to fight. For a few, an opportunity came during the replacements crisis at the time of the Bulge. Within General Lee's SOS were thousands of physically fit black soldiers whose jobs could be done by limited duty personnel. Lee offered them an opportunity to volunteer for the infantry, then be placed in otherwise white units without regard to a quota, but as needed. When Chaif, Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Walter B. Smith, read a circular Lee had put out, he stormed into Lee's office. Smith had been in charge of Negro policy for the Army in 1941. He told Lee, "It is inevitable that this circular will get out, and equally inevitable that the result will be that every Negro organization, pressure group, and newspaper will take the attitude that while the War Department segregates colored troops into organizations of their own against the desires and pleas of all the Negro race, the Army in Europe is perfectly willing to put them in the front lines, mixed in units with white soldiers, and have them do battle when an emergency arises." Breathing deeply, Smith went on, "2 years ago, I would have considered this the most dangerous thing that I have ever seen in regard to Negro relations." "I can't see that at all," Lee replied. Whatever his faults, he stood tall on this one. "I believe it is right that colored and white soldiers should be mixed in the same company." "I'm not arguing with that, one way or the other," Smith snapped. "But the War Department policy is different." Smith couldn't persuade Lee, but he did convince Eisenhower to maintain an essential segregation in ETO. The Supreme Commander declared that Negro volunteers would be trained as platoons and put into the line on that basis. At this point, Catch-22 took over. The replacement depots were not prepared to train platoons, only individuals. Individual replacements were badly needed in the all-black artillery and tank battalions, but the depots could train only infantry. There were 4,562 volunteers, many of them NCOs, who took a reduction to private to do so. The replacement depots were not prepared to handle so many. On March 1, 1945, the first 2,253 volunteers had completed their training. They were organized into 37 rifle platoons and sent to the front, where they were distributed as needed to the companies. The platoon leader and sergeant were assigned from the company and, of course, were white. With some exceptions, the platoons performed well. A few were outstanding. In general, their performance was so good it led many officers who served with them to reject segregation in the Army of the future. If anything, the judgment was that they were too aggressive. In one case, 3 black soldiers used a captured Panzerfaust to knock out a Tiger tank. They were rewarded with a week in Paris. Thereafter, there were many black soldiers seen stalking the enemy's armored monster with Panzerfaust in hand. Major General Edwin Parker, CO of the 78th Division, said of his Negro platoons, "Morale, excellent. Manner of performance, superior. Men are very eager to close with the enemy and to destroy him. When given a mission, they accept it with enthusiasm, and even when losses to their platoon were inflicted, the colored boys pressed on." Jim Crow was on the run, but not done. In the last month of the war, the worry became, what happens when we move into barracks? It was unthinkable that blacks and whites would share the same barracks. In the event, that worry proved to be misplaced. After 2 months in an integrated barracks, a battalion commander in the 78th Division said he had no problems of any kind and explained, "White men and colored men are welded together with a deep friendship and respect born of combat and matured by a realization that such an association is not the impossibility that many of us have been led to believe. When men undergo the same privations, face the same dangers before an impartial enemy, there can be no segregation. My men eat, play, work, and sleep as a company of men, with no regard to color." There were other hopeful signs that the Army would soon be rid of Jim Crow. Yank magazine did print Corporal Timmingham's letter. A couple of months later, he wrote again. "To date, I've received 287 letters," he said. "And strange as it may seem, 183 are from white men in the armed service. Another strange feature about these letters is that the most of these people are from the Deep South. They are all proud that they are from the South, but ashamed to learn that there are so many of their own people who are playing Hitler's game. Nevertheless, it gives me new hope to realize that there are doubtless thousands of whites who are willing to fight Jim Crow." Yank noted that it had received thousands of letters from GIs, almost all of whom were outraged by the treatment given the corporal. After the experience of World War II, by the end of 1945, the ground had been prepared for Jim Crow's grave. Chief historian Wright concluded his wartime report on the employment of Negro troops with these words, "My ultimate hope is that in the long run it will be possible to assign individual Negro soldiers and officers to any unit in the Army where they are qualified as individuals to serve efficiently." That was done under the command and leadership of the colonels, majors, captains, and lieutenants of ETO, who had seen with their own eyes. Within a decade, the Army had changed from being one of the most tightly segregated organizations in the country to the most successfully integrated. Chapter 15. Prisoners of War. One of the most dangerous moments in combat in Europe in World War II came the instant a man decided he was no longer willing or able to continue combat. He threw down his weapon and raised his hands or showed a white flag, sometimes alone, sometimes in a group, sometimes in company strength or even more, and thus exposed himself to an armed enemy soldier he had been trying to kill a moment before, and who was frequently mad with battle lust. His chances of getting shot were high. They stayed high until he was safely in the rear in a POW cage. Most of the men who stuck to their guns until out of ammunition and about to be overrun, before throwing up their hands and calling, "Comrade!" never made it to POW status. The German trick of sending unarmed men on patrols so that if caught they could say they were trying to surrender made it difficult and dangerous for individual Germans to give up, as the GIs shot all Germans found between the lines. The Germans were equally unforgiving. The Schaeff war crimes files are stuffed with incidents. Case 6-123, Company B, 394th Infantry. Near Losheim, on 17 December, the Germans surrounded a platoon. The GIs raised a white flag, but German tanks nevertheless overran the position, covering some men with earth and firing into the foxholes. Somehow 22 men managed to surrender. The Germans herded them into a nearby draw and gunned them down. Only the aid man escaped. Case 6-156. Witness, Private Andrew S. Protz. At Hunsfeld, five U.S. soldiers raised a white flag and came forward. The Germans opened fire, killing four and wounding one, whereupon a German tank deliberately ran over the wounded man as he begged for help. Private Edward Weber of the 47th Infantry Regiment described a gruesome but hardly unique incident. He was advancing on a damaged German tank. The crew had ceased firing its machine gun, opened the turret, and were waving a white flag. Weber and his buddies moved forward. The machine gun began firing again, probably by some young fanatic who refused to give up with the rest. Weber's squad fired back. "The crew came pouring out of the bottom escape hatch," Weber said. "They were hollering, 'Nick Schießen, Nick Schießen!' But by this time we were in an infuriated rage. The crewmen were lined up on their knees, and an angry soldier walked along behind them and shot each in the back of the head. The last to die was a young blonde-headed teenager who was rocking back and forth on his knees, crying and urinating down both trouser legs. He had pictures of his family spread on the ground before him. Nevertheless, he was shot in the back of the head and pitched forth like a sack of potatoes." Sergeant Zane Schlemmer of the 82nd Airborne treated POWs differently. "We had developed an intense hatred for anything and everything German," he wrote in a memoir. "We were particularly unhappy about sending them as prisoners to our rear. We had to stay up there and resented anyone going back to shelter and warmth. So we always cut their belts and, with our jump knives, cut the buttons off their pants, so that they had to hold up their pants in order to keep them. It was humiliating for them, particularly the officers." Both the American and the German army outlawed the shooting of unarmed prisoners. Both sides did it frequently, but no courts-martial were ever convened for men charged with shooting prisoners. It is a subject everyone agreed should not be discussed, and no records were kept. Thus, all commentary on the subject is anecdotal. I've interviewed well over 1,000 combat veterans. Only one of them said he shot a prisoner, and he added that while he felt some remorse, he would do it again. Perhaps as many as one-third of the veterans I've talked to, however, related incidents in which they saw other GIs shooting unarmed German prisoners who had their hands up. The general attitude was expressed by Lieutenant Tom Gibson of the 101st Airborne, who told me in graphic detail of the murder of 10 German POWs by an American airborne officer. He shot them while they were digging a ditch and were under guard. Gibson commented, "I firmly believe that only a combat soldier has the right to judge another combat soldier. Only he knows how hard it is to retain his sanity, to do his duty, and to survive with some semblance of honor. You have to learn to forgive others, and yourself, for some of the things that are done." For the airmen who had to bail out over Germany, the most dangerous moment was when they hit the ground. If local civilians got to them before military officials arrived, they would attack the Americans with rocks, pitchforks, and hunting weapons. Many were killed by non-combatants, overwhelmed by anger and hatred. In the November fighting, Lieutenant Fussell's infantry platoon came on a deep crater in a forest where a squad or two of German soldiers, some 15 to 20 men, were gathered. Their visible wish to surrender, most were in tears of terror and despair, was ignored by our men lining the rim, Fussell later wrote. As the Germans held their hands high, Fussell's men, laughing and howling, hoo-haing and cowboy and good old boy yelling, exultantly shot into the crater until every single man down there was dead. If a body twitched or moved at all, it was shot again. The result was deep satisfaction, and the event was transformed into amusing narrative, told and retold over campfires all that winter. Sergeant Robert Jameson, 90th Infantry Division, recalled an incident during the Bulge.
"We stopped a German tank with our bazooka and retrieved two of its crew. One had been very badly wounded in the leg. Some bastard lieutenant queried him about his outfit, and he refused to answer. The lieutenant then shoved him out of the door and shot him in the back. That was the closest I came to killing one of our own."
Captain Charles Stockel was in a position near Elsinborne Ridge.
"We had a young private, a sweet-natured 19-year-old kid who had two brothers killed in Normandy. It turned him into a fiend where Germans were concerned. He killed everyone he could, including any prisoner. It had become a court-martial offense to send a prisoner back with Junior."
During the Bulge, Stockel was standing with a battalion commander outside the headquarters. The CO needed to send a note to one of the companies. He called Junior over and gave him the mission.
"Junior trotted off down the street. A German who had been hiding in one of the houses for 72 hours appeared at the front gate, bowing, smiling, hands on his head. 'Kamerad, Kamerad!' Junior never broke stride, but pulled his pistol and shot the man in the face as he jogged past. The CO swore and dashed his helmet to the ground. Junior had struck again."
Most of the shooting stories are not so cold-blooded. Generally, they are about frontline riflemen immediately after a firefight in which they had seen buddies killed. On the American side, almost never did officers give direct orders to shoot prisoners. The word the paratroopers spread among themselves before D-Day was, "No prisoners per orders of General Gavin, or Ridgway, or Taylor." But I've not seen any documentary evidence for this order, and in fact, the paratroopers took many prisoners on June 6th. There is a written order from headquarters, 328th Infantry Regiment, dated December 21st, which reads, "No SS troops or paratroopers will be taken prisoner, but will be shot on sight." The excuse for that order was the Malmedy Massacre. That event occurred on December 17th. Battery B, 285th Field Artillery Observation Battalion of the 7th Armored Division, was moving southward toward Saint-Vite when Piper's lead elements ran into the unit outside Malmedy. Piper drove into the column, shooting and creating complete confusion. GIs abandoned their vehicles in panic and dove for the ditches, or tried to run to the nearby forest. Piper ordered them rounded up and drove on. Whether Piper gave a direct order to shoot the prisoners or not is not clear. It is known that he had been an adjutant of Heinrich Himmler, and that as a battalion commander in Russia, he burned two villages and killed all the inhabitants. The veteran SS troops he led into the Ardennes had long experience on the Eastern Front, where shooting POWs was a commonplace. Hitler had issued a directive that in the Ardennes the German troops should be preceded by a wave of terror and fright, and that no human inhibition should be shown. This first came to light when Lieutenant Colonel George Mabry, one of the heroes of Utah Beach on D-Day, reported that his battalion had captured a German colonel who had Hitler's written order on him. Over the first 4 days of the Bulge, when his panzers were on the move, Piper's command murdered approximately 350 American POWs and at least 100 unarmed Belgian civilians. But Piper was not present at Malmedy while the GIs from Battery B were rounded up, about 150 of them. A second panzer column approached. The Germans parked a tank at either end of a snow-covered field near the wood. A command car drew up. The German officer stood up, pulled his pistol, took deliberate aim at an American medical officer in the front rank of the POWs, and shot him. As the doctor fell, the German shot an officer next to him.
Then the two tanks opened up with their machine guns on the POWs. Private Homer Ford was one of the prisoners. He later testified, "They started to spray us with machine gun fire, pistols and everything. Everybody hit the ground. Then they came along with pistols and rifles and shot some that were breathing and hit others in the head with rifle butts. I was hit in the arm, and of the four men who escaped with me, one had been shot in the cheek, one was hit in the stomach, and another in the legs." Men took off for the wood, and many made it. Of the 150 POWs, 70 survived. As a massacre by World War II standards, that wasn't much. And Hugh Cole's conclusion in his official history of the Bulge is, "So far as can be determined, the Piper killings represent the only organized and directed murder of prisoners of war by either side during the Ardennes battle." But the cold-bloodedness of the Malmedy atrocity sent an electric shock through the U.S. Army. The dead were discovered by a patrol a couple of hours after the deed. Cole remarked that, "The speed with which the news of the Malmedy massacre reached the American frontline troops is amazing." By nightfall, the word had gone out to the foxholes, over a 100-kilometer front, that the Germans were shooting American POWs. This had two effects. First, many SS troopers who surrendered were shot. Second, GIs who were thinking of surrendering changed their minds. The Malmedy massacre seemed to many Americans to be the perfect example of Nazi brutality. After the war, it was the subject of extensive hearings before a U.S. military tribunal at Dachau. 73 former members of Piper's SS command were tried. 43 were sentenced to death, 22 to life imprisonment, including Piper, and 8 to prison terms of 10 years. Many of these sentences were commuted. No one served his full sentence. American retaliation for Malmedy had already been extracted by the treatment of SS prisoners who fell into the GI's hands. Private J. Frank Brumbaugh of the 82nd Airborne remembered hiking past the site of the Malmedy massacre. "GIs and some POWs were out in the field. They were digging the solidly frozen bodies of the murdered American soldiers out of the snow, frozen in grotesque positions, with arms and legs in all positions." An hour or so later, he saw some paratroopers who had a bunch of Germans wearing either U.S. jump boots or infantry combat boots, obviously stolen from captive, wounded, or dead Americans. The American paratroopers shot those wearing combat boots out of hand, on the grounds that if they had taken them from wounded or captured GIs, they may have caused injury or death, because the snow was deep, the weather bitter cold. "Those German captives found wearing U.S. parachute boots were made to remove the boots and socks, roll their trousers above their knees, and march around in the snow until their feet were totally frozen and they could no longer feel a knife prick, nor walk." The prisoners were sent back to field hospitals where both feet had to be amputated. Brumbaugh commented, "I suppose it might be called an atrocity, but I felt at the time it was a brutal but effective means of teaching the Germans a valuable and necessary lesson, which was, you don't fuck with paratroopers." During the first days of the Bulge, there were many bizarre incidents involving prisoners. Lieutenant Walter Melford, a former AST peer who had earned a commission just before going into combat, was German-born. He had immigrated to the United States with his family in the mid-1930s and grown up in Brooklyn. He was in intelligence, and he was in great danger from both sides. When his unit was surrounded and the colonel was about to surrender, Melford got together with four other native-born Germans who had become GIs. they agreed they could not possibly surrender and took off. When they encountered an American patrol, Melford called out,
"Via Americans!"
"Hands up," was the reply, and the five men with German accents wearing American uniforms were all arrested. Melford told an MP that he was from Brooklyn. "Who plays shortstop for the Dodgers?" Melford didn't know. It took him a couple of days to properly identify himself. 2 months later, Melford was with an armored column attacking in the Ruhr industrial area. The American tanks trapped a German battalion in a large factory. The CO turned to Melford. "It would be quicker and easier if you could talk those guys into surrendering," he said. Melford mounted two loudspeakers on a tank, and it lumbered forward.
"Ihr seid vollkommen umzingelt," he called out.
"You are completely surrounded." A couple of hundred Germans came out waving white flags. The CO told Melford to march them into a liberated Russian POW compound. "I had them lined up in columns of four and sitting up there holding the mic. I gave the order, 'Forwards Marsch,' and headed them straight into the compound. It was just wonderful." One unknown German solved the problem of surrendering with a nice bit of imagination and guts. 20-year-old Sergeant James Pemberton of the 103rd Division led a night patrol near Mulhausen. He started off with 9 men. On the way back, he counted 10. "I had a problem, but I said nothing because I thought I knew what was going on and couldn't do anything about it. As soon as we got back to headquarters and into a lighted room, I had my rifle ready, and that crowd started yelling, 'Kamerad, Kamerad!' No weapons or anything. He'd been on guard duty, heard us, and decided he'd had enough of the war and just joined my squad and became a POW. The Germans got their first big bag of American POWs in the opening days of the Bulge, some 20,000. Altogether, the Germans took some 30,000 GIs and 26,000 airmen prisoner in Northwest Europe. The largest haul came on December 19th, when two regiments of the 106th Division surrendered. At 7,500 men, this was the largest mass surrender in the war against Germany. Private Ernest Vermont heard his lieutenant call out, "Cease fire!" Then, "Destroy your weapons!" For Vermont, "That was the worst thing I ever did in my life." The Germans rounded his unit up and started marching the GIs to the rear. They would take watches, spit on the Americans, or cuff them across the head. In one village, Vermont was stoned by some Hitler youth. "The humiliation of being taken prisoner was almost more than I could endure." Vermont used a word that seemed apt to many of the men of the 106th. Private Vonnegut refused to obey the order to surrender. He took off with three others to try to make it back to American lines. Tall, skinny, no overcoat, no weapon, no boots. Shots rang out. The GIs dove into a ditch. After 10 minutes, they crawled into a forest like the big unlucky mammals they were. Their luck got worse. They were trapped and forced to surrender. But luck returned. They were not shot, but marched off to the east. As they hiked, at each road junction, another group of GIs joined them. They were going downhill, like water, growing in numbers as they merged on the main highway on the valley floor. Tens of thousands of Americans shuffled eastward, their hands clasped on top of their heads. Vonnegut called it a river of humiliation. Corporal Roger Farringer of the 99th Division was marched into a barracks, where a young German soldier approached him for interrogation. "I gave him the glare, and he gave me the finger. He had good English, and the first thing he did was shove his Luger into my stomach and pull the dog tags off my neck. Then he got Ferringer going in a conversation on his home life, what he did before the war, where he went to school. It wasn't a very thorough interrogation, Ferringer felt. The German almost certainly felt otherwise, that he had gotten everything he could. Corporals don't have much information in any army. The following day, December 19th, Ferringer began a four-day march. The first day, "We were marching by rows and rows of German troops, tanks and half-tracks, and horse-drawn artillery, every imaginable type. They bedded down in a straw pile. They were not fed. On the third day, we ran out into a sugar beet field that had been turned over. I had never seen a sugar beet in my life, but I ran out in the field and grabbed one, and the Germans didn't shoot. And lo and behold, it was something that gave me energy, sugar, heat, and the strength to go on." Eventually, the GI POWs reached railheads, where they were loaded onto French railway cars that the Germans had used as cattle cars. The floors were covered with manure. The GIs were sealed in, from 80 to 100 plus to a car, so tightly packed together there was not room for a man to sit, much less lie down. Even the dead remained standing. There were no waste facilities beyond an occasional tin bucket. The stench was unbearable, except that it had to be borne. Sometimes twice a day, sometimes once, sometimes not at all, the Germans opened the cars and gave the men water. The long, slow freight trains made ideal targets for P-47s, and the American pilots continually raked the unmarked cars with machine gun fire and hit them with rockets. Many died, German and American. Pilot Lieutenant Jim McCubbin was in a boxcar that two P-47s attacked. Watching the bombs leave the wings, he said, "That gave me a feeling of life in the infantry. I was much more scared than I had ever been in the air." He was thankful that the Germans had a flak car that was shooting back. "If it hadn't been for their firing, the P-47s would have made several more passes. I should know. I had done this frequently." Private Vermont recalled being strafed by machine gun fire. "The bullets came through the boxcar, killing many men. I believe I was the only one left alive. The others had either been killed or were badly wounded." It was the worst experience almost every man who had it ever had. When they finally arrived at the various camps in central and eastern Germany, the POWs had widely different experiences, depending on which service they came from, their rank, and most of all, the camp administration and guards. Goering had a romantic view of the Knights of the Sky and a sense of brotherhood with fellow pilots. The Luftwaffe ran the camps holding down flyers. Except for inadequate rations, the Army Air Force POWs fared relatively well. But as one prisoner of the Luftwaffe observed, "The German rations were just enough to ensure starvation in the most prolonged and unpleasant form." Lieutenant McCubbin, the P-47 pilot, who was shot down and entered a prison camp near Nuremberg on his 24th birthday, described the conditions. "The good news was that the soup had peas. The bad news was that over half the peas had worms in them. We soon stopped discarding the worst ones to just squeezing out the worms to finally just enjoying the protein. We slept on a hard floor in groups to conserve body heat and to share the one blanket. When one person's pain became unbearable, we would all roll to the other side in unison." To the prisoners, by far the most important provision of the 1929 Geneva Convention on POWs was the one on rations, which required that they be equal to the ration received by the soldiers of the holding power. In the United States, there was more than enough food and the provision was met, even exceeded. In Europe, priorities had to be set and POWs came toward the end of the list. Nowhere outside the United States were POWs adequately fed. GIs who weighed 180 pounds when captured in the Bulge weighed 120 or 100 pounds when liberated. Private Vermont recorded, "I weighed 140 pounds when I went into prison and weighed 92 pounds when I was released." And the GIs had been marginally better fed than Russian POWs or concentration camp inmates. In general, meals consisted of black bread and thin potato soup twice a day. Colonel Joe Matthews of the 106th Division recalled that he sometimes got green hornet soup made of beet tops and horse meat. It got its name because its surface was covered with maggots stained green from the beet tops. Among the prisoners, there were heated arguments over eating the maggots. Matthews, an agricultural chemist, decided they were protein and ate them. Enlisted infantrymen fared even worse. One sergeant reported that, "I went from 135 pounds to 95 pounds in 4 months of imprisonment. All we were given to eat was a cup of soup and a piece of ersatz bread each day. This was a systematic brutality to keep us dependent on the next meal, and too weak to try to escape. I had frozen feet, jaundice, fleas, lice, dysentery, 2 foot infections, and general malnutrition. The only difference between the concentration camps and the Stalag I was in was that we were not killed off with gas or bullets. I do not remember one act of mercy or compassion on the part of the Germans." There is ample testimony from those who were there that German officers and guards at some camps murdered or ill-treated POWs by forcing them to labor in inhumane conditions, by torturing them and subjecting them to constant, pointless harassment. There is other testimony that indicates the Germans did the best they could in a difficult situation. And there is something ironic about the inhumane conditions under which many prisoners labored. The cause was the Allied air forces. In city after city, following a raid, POWs in camps nearby were brought in to clean up. That's how Private Vonnegut was brought face to face with the horror of a major raid, Dresden, February 1945, and came to write Slaughterhouse 5. Corporal Feringer had a similar experience. He was in Würzburg in March 1945 when the British firebombed the city. Ordered into a cellar and then out again, he felt the most tremendous wind you've ever felt, and the whole sky and city of Würzburg seemed to be in flames. The incendiary bombs had hit the roofs of the buildings throughout the city and set them on fire. The fires burnt through the roofs, down to the floors, the debris falling inward after it, and incinerated the civilians hiding in the cellars. For the next week, Feringer and his fellow prisoners worked to remove the debris and carry out the dead. In most cases, being a POW in World War II was about as bad a human experience as one could have. For certain, there was nothing good to be said about being a POW. Which was worse, being a German in Russian hands or a Russian in German hands? An American in Japanese hands or a Pole in German or Russian hands? No one can say. But on a scale of horror, they all rank ahead of being an American in German hands. For comparison's sake, between 34% and 38% of Americans held by the Japanese as prisoners died. About 2/3 of Russian prisoners held in Germany appear to have died. And the proportion of Germans captured on the Eastern Front who died has been estimated as high as 80%. In the West, 0.7% of Americans held as POWs by the Germans died. 1% of the Germans held by the Americans died. How the U.S. Army treated its prisoners is a part of the story of its campaign in Northwest Europe. The Americans took their first big bag of German POWs, over 100,000, in Tunisia in May 1943. Eisenhower complained that they had never taught him at West Point what to do with so many prisoners. The War Department made the common-sense decision to bring them to the States. They could be brought over in troop transports returning from North Africa that would otherwise be empty. They could work on America's farms, where the labor shortage was acute. I saw my first German soldiers in June 1944 in Whitewater, Wisconsin. They were members of the Africa Corps, and they were frightening to an 8-year-old. Big, strong, blonde, hard-working, well-disciplined. Next to them, the GI guard, even with his Tommy gun slung over his shoulder, looked puny. I watched the Germans work alongside my mother at the local pea cannery, sorting debris out of the shelled peas, and that helped take the Superman image away. These were just farm boys doing what farm boys do. More big bags of prisoners came at Falaise, and in the fall battles, and then during the Bulge. From August through December, the troop ships bringing young Americans to Europe to fight were taking young Germans to America to farm. Some 400,000 each way. The best place of all to be in the winter of 1944 through 45 for a German male born between 1910 and 1927 was in a POW camp in the United States. There the German soldiers had security, shelter, and ample sustenance. They had a soft, cushy life, enhanced by hard physical labor in the day, something most Germans loved to do, including university classes in subjects ranging from English literature to advanced mathematics, movies, humane guards, a decent camp administration. Private Josef Bischoff was an Austrian captured in December 1944. He was sent to Colorado, where he worked on beet and potato farms. Many of the farmers whose fields he worked were second-generation German-Americans, still speaking the old language and holding to many of the old ways. "They would tell us," Bischoff recalled. "Now, boys, if you work hard today, my wife will have fried chicken for you tonight with pie and ice cream, and we would really pitch in." When the war ended, Bischoff wanted to stay in the United States. Austria was in a shambles, he had no family, and "in America they let you work as much as you want." Young and healthy, Bischoff figured it would only take him a few years to start climbing, owning his own house, running his own business. But in 1946, he and his buddies were sent home. POW camps were scattered throughout the United States. Generally, the prisoners spent their days in the fields, their nights in barracks previously occupied by the young Americans, now sailing to Europe or fighting there. Often, the guards were Negro soldiers. It is one of the war's many ironies that the soldiers of the nation fighting for racial purity and the domination of the world were shocked by the way white Southerners treated blacks. They said indignantly that Germans had treated the blacks better in their pre-World War I African colonies, and the planters proved the point by treating German POWs better than they did the local black laborers. In the cotton fields, for example, the daily quota for black pickers was 250 pounds, for the POWs, 100 pounds. In a camp in Louisiana, the Germans suffered terribly from the heat and humidity in the cane fields, but they prospered with the community. They went to the Saturday night movies downtown, where they sat downstairs while the blacks sat in the balcony reserved for colored. They went unescorted. A man would have had to have been some kind of fool, or Nazi, or both, to try to escape and get back to Germany. I know of only one who did so. They attended local dances. There were some romances and even a few marriages. The system worked to everyone's benefit. The crops got planted, cultivated, harvested. The prisoners were better off than they ever would have been in the Wehrmacht. The U.S. Army, in its treatment of POWs, compiled a record of decency and efficiency in an area in which all other countries, save Britain and Canada, must today hang their heads in shame. In April 1945, a rebuilt American division that had more of its former members in German POW camps than any division in the Army, the 106th Infantry, was rushed from Rennes, France, to Germany to deal with a desperate situation, the mass surrender of hundreds of thousands of German soldiers. The 106th was needed to guard and care for the prisoners. At one point, the division was responsible for 330,000 men. Despite a shortage of food, medicine, and shelter, the 106th carried out its mission well. The men earned the commendation from their CO, Major General D.A. Stroh. "Your superior performance has reflected great credit to all concerned." Still, there was some brutality, considerable hardship, much illness, and a relatively high death rate. As official Army historian Albert Caudrey reminds us, conditions in the terribly overcrowded American POW camps in Germany in the spring of 1945 offer a sobering corrective to any remaining illusion that in World War II all the inhumanity was on one side. But with regard to the widely publicized charge that the United States deliberately starved 1 million POWs to death, it is a monstrous lie. Part 4. Overrunning Germany. At the beginning of the new year, the GIs once again went on the offensive. They had rough terrain, the Siegfried Line, mighty rivers and deep ravines to cross, all defended by German soldiers fighting for their homeland. Conditions were miserable. It was one of the worst winters ever in northwestern Europe. It was fought, in large part, by citizen soldiers who had been college students or high school graduates in 1944 and became frontline infantry in 1945. Chapter 16. Winter War. January 1945. On New Year's Eve, 1944, Lieutenant John Cobb, U.S. Military Academy, 1943, was in a ferry, part of a convoy crossing the English Channel. He was a replacement officer for the 82nd Airborne Division, on his way to Elsinboyne Ridge. "Notwithstanding blackout and security conditions," he wrote years later, still somewhat startled, "every ship in the channel sounded whistles or sirens or shot off flares at midnight on New Year's Eve." That same night, Corporal Paul Arthur Tsaya of the 11th Panzer Division was on the front line near Trier. "Just before midnight, the shooting stopped almost entirely," he remembered. "As the clock struck 12, the Americans began with their fireworks, sending illuminated rockets into the air. Suddenly, by the light of their rockets, we saw the Americans getting out of their holes, clutching their rifles and pistols, jumping, skipping around, shooting their weapons and lighting up the whole valley. I can still see them before me today, caught against the light of their rockets, prancing around on a background of fresh snow. It did not take long before we were doing the same thing, firing off illuminated rockets, shooting our weapons. It lasted about 5, maybe 6 minutes. It slowed, then stopped. We disappeared back into our holes, and so did they. It was one of the most beautiful experiences I had during my service. We had allowed our humanity to rise that once." The feeling was universal. the new year had begun. Surely this had to be the last year of the war. But the experience Corporal Tsaya had was unusual. To the north, the Americans shot at the enemy.
"I have seen quite a few New Years, including the Times Square one," Major John Harrison wrote home on January 1, 1945. "But I never saw one like last night. Just before 2400, the artillery all along the front opened up, throwing everything in the book at the crowd. And on the stroke of midnight, the AA began firing everything from 50 cals to 90 millimeters, filling the sky with lead poison for any lamplight Charlie, a lone German bomber that came over at night to do some harassing. Believe me, it was some spectacle from where I watched it, some 10 miles away. You could see the big guns belch flames, and also the flash that a few seconds later filled the sky. The noise was a rumble. It was truly a New Year's greeting that the krauts out in front will not forget. Two, it is no doubt the loneliest and coldest New Year's Eve that many Americans have ever spent." At the beginning of 1945, the Allies had driven the Germans back to or near their western border. Eisenhower had hoped to do better. In the fall of 1944, he had bet Montgomery £5 that the war would be over by Christmas. But gasoline shortages and the Siegfried Line had stopped his troops, and the counteroffensive in the Ardennes had thrown them back temporarily. Much had been gained, however. The Allies had liberated France and Belgium, and in the process killed, wounded, or captured hundreds of thousands of Germans, some of them woefully inadequate soldiers, some of them quite superb soldiers. Schaeff was a smoothly functioning machine. The supply lines running from the United States and Great Britain to the continent were secure and stuffed with men and materiel being sent to the front. A panoramic snapshot of ETO taken on January 1, 1945, would have shown, moving west to east, tankers and freighters and transports unloading at Le Havre, Antwerp, Cherbourg, long lines of trucks carrying men and supplies forward, tent city hospitals and corps and army headquarters, motor repair depots, supply dumps that covered many square miles and held all but unbelievable amounts of food, ammunition, clothing, fuel, vehicles, and more. Some villages and cities destroyed, some intact. Airfields scattered across France and Belgium, swarming with activity. A constant movement of tanks, cannon, both self-propelled and towed, jeeps and trucks, all headed east, closer to the German border, the big cannon lined up, the batteries spaced parallel with the front line, aid stations, more cannon, and at the front itself, American troops dug in, cold, hungry, exhausted, but victorious. A panoramic snapshot of Germany, starting in Berlin and going westward, would have shown city after city in ruin, on fire. In rural areas, little evidence of war. Along the Rhine River, the great industrial cities of the Rhine-Ruhr region in ruin. Between the Rhine and the Siegfried Line, nothing. If the weather was good, enough for the Jabos to operate. The most noticeable difference between the two snapshots would have been the complete absence of trucks or trains on the German side. Abandoned vehicles, some disabled by the Jabos, some by mechanical problems. No artillery in sight because of camouflage. And at the front itself, German troops dug in, cold, hungry, exhausted, and just defeated in their great offensive gamble.
This ends Disc 13.